True crime horror story contains extreme violence and adult subject matter. Listener discretion is advised.
I am your host, JD Horror, and this is True Crime Horror Story, Season 5, Episode 8, The Broadmoor Hall of Fame, Part 2. Welcome back to a place where if the walls could talk, they would tell you stories that chill your blood and freeze your bones. The cast of today's show has made themselves each a celebrity in their own right, and as diverse as their characters are, that is how different their prognosis and treatments were. The one thing they had in common was that they all ended up in Broadmoor because, despite their crimes being horrendous, they all indicated some form of mental illness or significant personality disorder that caused them to commit crimes that shook society. Although mental illness can be treated, some personality disorders can't, and when an expert makes a diagnosis on an illness or disorder that shows no physical symptoms, we can only hope they get it right. This is most likely why at least 3 psychiatrists must give an evaluation. But I'm sure a perfectly sane monster can sway specialists into sending him to a psychiatric institution instead of a prison. There they can receive more freedom, craft classes, better food, and the kind of care that prisons could never even hope to offer inmates. Let's get it started. Part 1. The Stockwell Strangler.
Two women and 5 men have been strangled since the beginning of April. The police have set up 4 incident rooms, including this one at Cannon Row. It's here information is collated, like the vague description of a young white man seen lurking in the shadows of an old people's home where 2 of the victims were found strangled in their beds. It's a big investigation, supervised from Scotland Yard by Detective Chief Superintendent Ken Thompson.
We have over 100 experienced detectives who are looking at these offences. On top of that, we have many police officers, extra police officers on the street wherever possible, and the extra patrols have been stepped up.
Forensic evidence the police are keeping to themselves, but they have identified a pattern. All 7 victims, including another who fought back and survived, were throttled. All the murders took place in the early hours of the morning. There were no signs of forcible entry and no signs of a burglary. Last and most significant, 5 of the 7 victims had been sexually interfered with. The police are warning old people to lock up, even on hot nights, and to watch for people, even relatives, acting strangely.
There's something specifically sadistic about strangulation as a method of murder. When wrapping a set of hands around a neck with a knee on the chest, you're inches away from your victim's face. It's intimate and personal, and one of the favorite forms of physical abuse and domestic violence. If you're the strangler, you're very close to your victim. You can see the veins in the victim's eyes burst as their lips turn blue and the life drains out of their body. Although lethal, it's also one of the hardest forms of aggression to inflict on another person, with many stranglers complaining that it took far longer than they anticipated and a lot more force than expected. They simply don't just drop dead like in the movies. Ironically, it takes only the pressure of a firm handshake to restrict the blood flow of oxygen and blood to your brain, and within seconds, brain cells will die and you'll be unconscious, but not before panic and fear override every other emotion. To the Stockwell Strangler, this method of murder would become his insignia. The summer of 1986 was a sweltering season, highlighted by heat waves, but the weather would not be the only disturbing factor that would make the community in the south of London, England, uneasy and uncomfortable. For a period of 17 weeks, being a retired elderly person might just make you the victim of the Stockwell Strangler. When an at-home aide arrived at her client's little council flat in Wandsworth, she assumed the poor dear had passed away peacefully in her sleep. After all, her charge seemed to have been tucked in and not disturbed. Retired teacher Nancy Eileen Ems seemed to live a solitary life at the age of 78, and her dementia was systematically stripping from her all of her dignity. It's only after she realized that Nancy's portable TV was missing that the trajectory of the entire case would change.
Eileen Ems was said to be a frail woman who weighed 6 stone and was just 4'9" tall. A retired schoolteacher who lived alone, her body was discovered by her home help in the basement flat in West Hill Road. She'd been savagely beaten and suffered a black eye before being strangled. The only clue so far is a missing 20-inch bed colour television, although there's no sign of a break-in or struggle. Detectives say she was last seen alive at 6:30 on Tuesday evening. Later that night, a scream was heard in a nearby yard. An incident room has been set up at Putney with a team of 24 detectives, now making house-to-house inquiries.
It used to be a practice of hers that she would go out of her flat, which is in a basement, into a covered courtyard, and it is said that she was heard out there somewhere in the region of about 11 o'clock at night. So we're looking for anybody who saw anybody hanging around in that area, anyone that they thought might be suspicious.
The police are also trying to discover if Eileen Ems had any family and have appealed for friends or relatives to contact them.
Her autopsy would reveal that she was raped and strangled, although whether the sexual assault took place after her death was unsure. Forensic evidence would reveal a palm print on the window, which was left ajar because of the stiflingly summer weather, as well as a hair that seemed to belong to someone from Caribbean descent. Sort of reminiscent of Richard Ramirez with the heat wave and people leaving their windows ajar. It would later be revealed that the killer had a very specific way of executing his crimes. He would surprise his victims by climbing upon their chest, covering their mouth with his left hand, and strangling them with his right hand, all the while grinning and saying, "Kill, kill, kill." Survivor Fred Prentice would testify later that a strangler would press and release several times, as if wanting to prolong the event. Semen stains were also retrieved, but it would be a little while before DNA specifics would be at the tip of a scientist's fingers. The killer would strike again almost 2 months later when he attacked 67-year-old Janet Cockett, but no link to the previous murder was made, apart from the fact that both ladies were elderly. Janet, who was still a spryly character and described as a sharp tack with a love for her mini felines, was found murdered, but not sexually assaulted, on June 9, 1986. Investigators did take note that the photographs of Janet's loved ones were either turned face down or towards the wall, which begged the question, did the killer feel remorse? Another palm print was lifted, but the task of comparing it to the thousands of prints the police had on record was incredibly time-consuming, and the identification would only come after more victims were sacrificed. With his third and fourth victims, there was no doubt that the police were dealing with a sexual deviant and a serial killer. Both brazenly occurred in a home for the elderly, and both victims were murdered on the same day. This time around, the Stockwell Strangler chose two men as victims, sodomizing one of them. He launched his attack on June 28th, and after the deed was done, he lingered around the crime scene. Polish immigrants Valentine Gleam, aged 84, Zbigniew Skrabowia, aged 94, hardly stood a chance. But what baffled staff and police was the fact that he used the facilities to wash and shave after his crimes. As usual, the frequency of attacks for this serial killer did increase, and on July 8th, 84-year-old William Carman would be robbed, molested, and murdered in a similar fashion as the previous victims. William Davies, age 74, would meet his demise on July 21st, murdered in his bed in Stockwell, and on July 23rd, Florence Tisdale, age 74, would be the Stockwell Strangler's final victim. Finally, because of the previous arrest leading to his fingerprints being on file, the Stockwell Strangler was identified days after his last murder. Since Kenneth Erskine had no fixed residential address, officers decided to wait until July 28th, and without incident, the murder of 7 elderly people was arrested as he picked up his social security check. But who was this man who instilled so much fear into the old folk in the south of London? Kenneth Erskine is described as the eldest child of a very dysfunctional family. Born on July 1st, 1963, He's described as mixed race, and he and his three younger brothers frequently had to witness violence between his parents. He was a strange child, with staring eyes and a maniacal grin always on his face. For the most part, he attended schools for children with special needs. It's been reported that he was abandoned by both parents after they decided to get a divorce when he was 12 years old. His volatile behavior didn't improve, and he was prone to unpredictable and violent outbursts. It was also around the time of his parents' divorce that Kenneth tried to drown fellow pupils during school. He also stabbed a teacher in the hand and would randomly throw his fellow students off the bus they took from school to home. Incidents of him exposing himself and masturbating were also reported as disturbing behavior. After a series of foster homes, the teenager became homeless and would support himself by committing burglaries. It was during these years on the streets of London that Kenneth began abusing alcohol and hard drugs. When he was arrested at the age of 23, he had no friends and was described as an odd loner. He also had 10 different bank accounts into which he deposited the proceeds of his burglaries. The total of the accounts would amount to almost £3,000, which begs the question, why would he choose to be homeless? The Crown decided to prosecute Kenneth Erskine for the 7 known murders that they had direct evidence for, although there were in total 11 murders they could link him to.
23-year-old Kenneth Erskine from Shepherd's Bush appeared in the dock here at the Old Bailey, initially handcuffed to a prison warder. In a barely audible whisper, he pleaded not guilty to 7 counts of murder and 1 charge of attempted murder. His alleged victims were aged between 67 and 94, and they were apparently killed between April the 9th, 1986, and July the 23rd, the date of the royal wedding. Mr. James Crespi, who was prosecuting, told the jury that there were striking similarities in all the cases. He said the victims were all elderly and lived alone or in old people's homes. They were all strangled and were killed by either an intruder or a burglar. They were all left in their beds with the bedclothes neatly arranged around them. And 5 out of the 7 who were murdered were all subject to the same form of serious sexual assault, either before or after they were killed. The first of Erskine's alleged victims was 78-year-old Eileen Ems from Wandsworth, killed around June the 9th. About the same time as 67-year-old Janet Cockett, who lived on the Overton Road estate in Stockwell. Some 10 days later, there was the attempted murder of 73-year-old Frederick Prentice, who lived in an old people's home in Clapham. The following day, an intruder here at the Somerville Hastings House, old people's home in Stockwell, claimed 2 victims. The first, 81-year-old Valentine Gleam, and then, probably very soon afterwards, said Mr. Crespi, his neighbour, Zbigniew Varwa, who was 94. Early the following month, 82-year-old William Carman was found dead at his home on the Marquis Road estate in Islington. 10 days later, a second victim was found on the Overton Road estate in Stockwell, William Downs, aged 74. And finally, 3 days later, Florence Tisdall, aged 80, was found dead at her home in Putney. Mr. Crespi suggested to the jury that the pattern of the attacks was so similar that they couldn't be explained away simply by coincidence and must, he believed, be the work of the same person. The case here continues and is expected to last for about 4 weeks.
The evidence of survivor Fred Prentice was also invaluable. Fred was attacked in the same manner, but his ability to call for help via a panic button saved his life, and his identification would be priceless. Kenneth's odd behavior continued, with him falling asleep during his trial and even being caught masturbating at one point in the courtroom while proceedings were taking place. He would be found guilty of all charges and sentenced to life in prison in January of 1988, but after an even more obvious deterioration of his mental health, claiming he heard the voice of a whispering woman, he was sent to Broadmoor, where he's still housed to this day. There he would eventually receive the diagnosis of chronic schizophrenia, and that he had the mental capacity of a preteen, and despite his risk level being downgraded in 2016, it is unlikely he'll ever be released. In an ironic twist that could happen only in Broadmoor, Kenneth Erskine would save the life of the Yorkshire Ripper on February 3, 1996. The incident occurred when Peter Sutcliffe, from our previous Broadmoor Hall of Fame episode, had an altercation with fellow patient Paul Wilson about a video cassette. Paul grabbed a set of headphone cords, and according to staff, if it wasn't for the intervention of Kenneth, Peter would have died from the strangulation. This would, however, not be the only person who would be involved in altercations with the Yorkshire Ripper. Part 2, The Duke of Broadmoor.
We grew up in a world where men on both sides of the law were measured by a single store of value, and violence was the currency of choice.
If the old men didn't get you when you were growing up, chances were the bleeding Luftwaffe would.
Luckily, the twins could fight. They were schoolboy boxing champions. Both of them could have gone all the way. But it weren't the titles and the trophies that were the draw for them. It was the violence. And they found enough of that outside the ring to keep them more than happy.
Ex-supermodel Maureen Flanagan is the kind of lady that prides herself not only on her immaculate grooming, but also on always being on time. But somehow, the patient she visits regularly is always late. Of course, she understands that Ronnie Cray is a man who indulges in making an entrance, and therefore, waiting a couple more minutes doesn't bother her. Finally, she hears the deliberate marching sound of the general, and when the doors to the packed visitor's room open, he appears like an image from a glossy men's fashion magazine. His leather shoes are polished to a magnificent shine. His white shirt starched to perfection. The silk tie is perfectly knotted, and the Italian suit has clearly been tailored for him. To Ronnie, appearances were incredibly important, and every October, Maureen had a tailor measure him for a new suit, despite the fact that this visit in the lounge of Broadmoor is probably the only occasion he will ever wear it to. Peter Sutcliffe often sat a couple of seats away. He was given strict instructions not to speak to, look at, or even breathe in the direction of Ronnie. As often is the case with celebrities, the rumors are plenty. Peter would claim that he was on fantastic terms with the notorious gangster and even cut his hair. He alleges to even have procured a saw to try to escape with the aid of Ronnie Cray. Associate James Campbell, who regularly visited Ronnie in Broadmoor, claimed that Peter, during a fight, picked Ronnie up during a scuffle that was apparently because Peter was stealing some of his thunder. Ronnie often leaned over Maureen and whispered, "You know they're all mad in here." During the 50s and 60s, the Cray twins were large and in charge in the East End of London and were set to even expand their endeavor across the pond. They were carbon copies of each other, not only in features and face, but in the smallest of mannerisms. Ronnie, however, started to show signs of the paranoid schizophrenia that he would later be diagnosed with in his late teens and early 20s. Reggie was the more controlled and calculated one. It said that Ronnie killed many more men than his twin and would delight in the torture of victims, but both men were violent to the core. Despite gang rivalry, constant police surveillance, and a growing reputation, the boys moved their operation from the East End to the West, and if asked their occupation, they would proudly proclaim that they were nightclub owners. Ronnie would openly proclaim his sexuality as gay, which for the time caused quite a stir. Both brothers were fueled by violence, but where Reggie had an incredibly bad temper, Ronnie's erratic behavior was ignited by the mental illness that for the most part remained untreated. The dapper and debonair duo rubbed shoulders with famous celebrities like Judy Garland and Ann Windsor. All the glitz and glamour would instigate arson, theft, protection rackets, and a myriad of other crimes. Born on October 24, 1933, the two brothers seem almost untouchable from an early age. One tale that defines their legacy is when they signed up for national service in 1952, they continued to desert their posts. When captured, they assaulted a policeman. They were held at the Tower of London as some of the last guests to ever be housed there. Their behavior in prison was so bad that they were both dishonorably discharged from the service. They tried to dominate the exercise yard, threw tantrums, emptied their pee latrine buckets on a sergeant, dumped a container of hot tea on another, and eventually the two were subdued with tranquilizers. However, their infamy and fame would catch up with them when on May 8, 1968, both brothers were arrested on the charge of murder, with the judge proclaiming that society needed a rest from their antics. Ronnie would kill George Cornwell after the gangster called him a fat poof. This crime would be committed in broad daylight in front of patrons of the Blind Beggar's Bar, which speaks volumes to the feeling of being untouchable that the brothers displayed. Ronnie had been drinking in another pub when he heard that the man who had insulted him so badly was at the Blind Beggar, and without hesitation, he marched to confront his nemesis. All George had the opportunity to say was, "Well, look who's here," before Ronnie walked up to him and shot him in the head. This incident on March 9, 1966 would prove to be his major mistake, because despite warning staff and patrons of the bar not to breathe a word of what they saw, a barmaid would eventually break her silence and testify against him. Despite the brothers trying to get other members to take a fall for their crimes, the Crown decided that both men were guilty and sentenced them to life in prison. Eventually, Ronnie's mental health would deteriorate so much that he would be sent to Broadmoor, where he would pass away on March 17th of 1995. Even in Broadmoor, Ronnie would continue to conduct his lucrative business and even organize 18 bodyguards for Frank Sinatra when the legendary crooner graced the stages of England. His mental illness would, however, show itself every now and then. As his good friend Maureen would later tell reporters, there would be days where he would be fidgeting and wringing his hands, and when he was in that sort of mood, clearly agitated, the visits would abruptly be cut short. The brothers would be allowed to see each other one last time in 1982, when under heavy guard, the twins left their mark on the history of the London underworld.
This was never going to be just a quiet family funeral. Nearly 500 friends, neighbours, and the simply curious turned out to say goodbye to Violet Cray. Some of her family have been described as the most evil villains London has ever known. To 72-year-old Vi, they were and remained sons who needed love and affection. She called the Cray twins Ronnie and Reggie, now serving life for vicious gangland murders, my lovely boys, and faithfully visited them all over the country. In the shadow of the council flats that have been the family home for 15 years, their floral tributes, roses on chrysanthemums, rested among 300 other wreaths, including one display of red and yellow carnations and lilies, signed simply from the boys in Parkhurst. There were more flowers from film stars, underworld figures, and an ex-great train robber or two. One of Vi's ex-neighbours, Ellen Clement, remembered her with respect.
I know her as a neighbour, an ex-neighbour, and I used to meet her almost every Sunday getting her paper, and to me she was a very fine woman. Yeah. And she had more energy, and I was so surprised it happened. Had more energy in her than lots of these youngsters. She used to really, you know, walk quickly, run along the street. Yeah. She was she always asked after my son and my grandchildren, and she didn't even know him. She was a fantastic woman.
Half an hour late, the cortege wound its way through the East End the Crays knew so well 13 years ago, to the little Chingford Old Church, now swamped by this unaccustomed congregation and publicity. Hidden inside, Ronnie and Reggie waited, released for a day but handcuffed to their minders, their first real taste of the outside world for 13 years. After a 30-minute service, Ronnie and Reggie were allowed to hug their relatives and close friends for a matter of seconds. Then they filed out of the church, leaving the twins under tight security. 10 tense minutes later, as the security cordon tightened around the little Chingford church, out of a back door came a diminutive Reggie Cray, dwarfed by his guards on either side. And a few seconds later, his bespectacled twin brother Ronnie. The short walk down the side of the church was their final breath of fresh air. They weren't allowed to go to the graveside, but were whisked back to their separate prisons, Ronnie to Broadmoor, Reggie to Parkhurst. Meanwhile, an even bigger crowd rushed to the graveside service for Vi, next to where Reggie's wife Frances is buried. Among the famous faces was Diana Dawes. Close family rubbed shoulders with the merely nosy, and the surrounding graves were trampled underfoot. For elder brother Charlie Cray, it had been an emotional time.
All I'd like to say as well that, you know, for the people, the kindness, I can't believe. I mean, I just can't believe it. It amazed me with the amount of Reeves and the way people behaved. In fact, everybody.
Don't you find it strange that in spite of your family's reputation, you get all this support?
Well, I've got an answer for that, really, is that whatever they did, no one I condone, but at the same time, one thing I keep insisting about is they've never harmed the public, you see, and they let people out who do harm the public and kill children and women, they still release them, but the twins, they never do. I mean, they've never harmed the public. Whatever they did was wrong, they know it, but if they let them out tomorrow, the public's not got to run away.
Then it was over. The black limousines took the family away from the crowds, back to their local pub in the city, and at last Violet Cray could rest in peace.
Next time we visit back to Broadmoor, we'll be visiting a serial killer, a cannibal, and we'll find out why the sirens at Broadmoor became such an institution. Kind of a short episode this week, guys. I'm sorry for the delay. I've been going through some stuff personally and with my health, but things are starting to turn around, and we're going to be back on schedule. We'll have more Broadmoor up on our Patreon soon, as well as another bonus episode. And when we return in 2 weeks with another episode, we'll be talking about a heavy hitter that I've been waiting to cover since this show started. It's one of the most fascinating cases of all time. Until then, like I'm trying to, take care of your own mental health. Because neither one of us wants to end up in a place like Broadmoor. Thanks for joining us for Season 5, Episode 8 of True Crime Horror Story. We'll be back in 2 weeks with another episode. Suggested movie similar to today's cases, First/Last Kill, a 2014 documentary about Kenneth Erskine directed by Nick Ahrens. And The Craze, a 1990 British biopic directed by Peter Medak. If you like what you hear here on True Crime Horror Story, please subscribe and give us a 5-star review. You can also think about joining our Patreon at www.patreon.com/truecrimehs. Then stay tuned after this show on Patreon for the True Crime Horror Story After Show with Dom and JD, as well as early access to ad-free episodes and exclusive bonus content available only on Patreon. This episode features research and writing by Misdemeanor, music by Mechanical Ghost, producer LB from the No One Likes This podcast, and The Quiet Type, as well as artwork by Nuclear Heat Graphics. Sources for this episode's cases are available in the credit section of our website. Has violent crime impacted you or someone close to you? Send us your story at truecrimehorrorstory@gmail.com. True Crime Horror Story. Sometimes truth is more brutal than fiction.
My name is John Lorden, and I've been looking into hundreds of unsolved mysteries over the past 5 years on my YouTube channel, Lorden Arts. And I've been known to bring a respectful, victim-focused approach to the stories that I cover while donating thousands of dollars directly to those cases and the charities that help them. Now, I'm bringing that approach and sensibility, along with some of the biggest mysteries I've ever looked into and some new ones, to a weekly podcast called Seriously Mysterious. From bizarre occurrences to unsolved murders and unexplainable disappearances, everything is fair game on this show as long as it's seriously mysterious. You can find Seriously Mysterious on your favorite podcatchers or by visiting seriouslymysterious.com. Let's look into the mysterious together.